Hey guys and gals, welcome to a new episode of the Landscape Photography Podcast. This is usually a German language format, but once in a while I do invite some of my favorite international photographers for an English episode. This is one of those episodes, and my guest today is none other than Samuel Scicluna, which is a Maltese photographer, and we had a lot of fun talking about all sorts of subjects. One is, of course, how he actually got into photography and how Malta, as a very unique location, informed his way of taking landscape photography pictures. We talked a lot about all sorts of different subjects, reaching from composition over to his love for the Icelandic highlands and other locations, all the way to some environmental topics. So there's a broad bunch of interesting topics for you to listen to, and I hope that you're going to have fun. If you want to have all the links to the photographers that popped up during the show, you can find those in the show notes at www.nicholasalexanderotto.net, which is my homepage. There in the section blog, you'll find all the links in the current episode. So the show notes should be containing also a couple of the pictures of Sam's work, the ones that we actually talked about on the show. For the full portfolio of Sam's work, you just go to samscicluna.com. There you can find the whole body of work that Sam has accumulated over the years. Now, usually this is the part where I do a little bit of preliminary advertising for my tours, because I am a workshop leader and I lead tours all over the world, but usually those are with German-speaking clients. But if you, for whatever reason, maybe because you think I'm a nice guy, want to be on the road with me to one of those destinations, just contact me. There's a broad variety of workshops that I run for German touring agencies. So the pages usually are German, but if something tickles your fancy pants, then you just get into contact with me and I'll make it happen. If you liked this episode and want to let me know that I actually did a good job, or maybe you have some constructive criticism, don't fear to reach out over the socials and just drop me a couple of lines. I'd very much appreciate that. Or if you fancy, you can also give me a 5-star review, none other than 5 stars, of course, on one of the platforms that you're listening to, be it Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or something else. And with that, I want to wish you a lot of fun with actually the 87th episode of the Landschaftsfotografie Podcast with Sam Scicluna. Hey there, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of the Landscape Photography Podcast, which is, as usual, a German format. But this time around, I actually have an English guest for you guys, none other than Sam Scicluna, which is a landscape photographer from Malta. First and foremost, thank you and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me on the show. It was great to finally meet you in person after several years of being friends on social media. And I'm glad we could sit down and have a chat.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering why it actually took us to actually meet up in person before I actually got you onto the podcast, because I've been following your work for a while now. And first thing that I usually ask people is a little bit more about their backstory of their photography and how they actually got started. And so this is the first question I'm also going to give to you. Nobody actually can escape this question. So how did your travels in photography actually start?
I got my first camera in 2012. And I think, like most people, when you get a camera, you just kind of, you don't really have a vision. You just kind of take pictures of everything you see, anything that catches your eye. So it wasn't very specific landscapes at first. It was a bit of everything, a bit of motorsport, a bit of landscapes, a bit of people. I used to spend a lot of time camping, and that's where I started to really get into landscapes, because, you know, spending night camping is ideal because you're there for sunset, you're there for sunrise. You don't have to worry about getting to a sunrise location too early or getting back after a late sunset. So camping was where I really started to enjoy landscapes. Then naturally, I started looking at other people's work. on Instagram, on 500px, on Facebook, and started to see, wow, there are some absolutely stunning landscapes in the world. And that kind of incentivized me to travel a bit more and start going to these places which I'd seen, and I wanted to capture them for myself. That was the initial start.
That makes perfect sense. I guess like most of us photographers or landscape photographers, that is, have a very similar origin story. But there is one major part that is very different for you that I found to be very interesting. And that is that usually you don't have as much space at your disposal. Looking at how you grew up on Malta, apparently, I was pretty interested in actually getting to know how you found your way through the islands that Malta consists of, because it's only a very, very small area. As far as Wikipedia told me, because I actually had to look this up, because I wasn't very familiar with Malta before actually preparing for the show, it's only like 320 square kilometers of soil, so
it's tiny.
Has that at first limited you a little bit?
It did and it didn't. So right now I feel guilty about it, but I haven't been out to shoot locally in probably 2 years because it just doesn't inspire me anymore. I've been to so many of the locations. I've been to pretty much all the good locations so many times, got the great sunrise or the great sunset or the dramatic weather, the moody clouds, the stormy seas. So right now, with having, you know, running this business and just being in the beginning of this, to me, it makes more sense to focus my time on the business and planning and the future rather than going out to shoot those same spots again. I hope that having a break for a while will eventually lead to me to be inspired to go back to those locations. But yeah, at first, it was always about going to those places, shooting them, hoping for the best conditions. But you know, if you've been to the same location not two or three times but 50 or 60 times, you do kind of lose the love for that particular location, because I've pretty much seen all the conditions I can imagine at those places. So it was definitely a challenge.
So you really went to some of the places like 50 or 60 times before actually getting the picture that we might now as viewers see on your homepage, because that is more effort that many people would actually put in through their pictures, like 50 times. Or was that just a random number that popped into your head?
No, there are definitely locations that have been to that many or more times. What you need to keep in mind is, like you said, Malta is very small. So it's only a 10-minute drive from home to get to the sea and an area where there are some nice sea caves, and we don't really have sea stacks, unfortunately, but it's all coastline being a small island. So you know, 10 minutes isn't too bad, especially in the winter when it's the sun is in the ideal location for that location. The sun is in the ideal, it rises in the ideal place for that location. You know, if the sun rises at like 6:30, 10 minute drive, be there half an hour before. You don't have to get up at like 4 a.m. like you do in summer.
Yeah, I reckon then there's a lot of experiences that you've had on the coastline that stay with you, though, because I was reading through a couple of your blogs, and one of the things that I came across was a night at Gozo. I don't know how to pronounce any of these names correctly. And you've written about how you actually went out with your friends and that there was a lot of like leisure time involved. So you went, scouted the location, then you went for a swim, then you drove back into like a village to actually eat something, and then you had a camp there waiting for the next morning, the sunrise. So there was a lot of like generally what people would consider fun involved. Has that kind of informed the way that you took photographs of those places? Because you said, like, even though it's only like a short amount of time that you have to travel to these locations with Malta being so small, why did you actually decide to stay overnight and camp if it's only just a couple of minutes drive away?
Well, that location, so Gozo is a separate island. It's not far away. It's a 25-minute ferry to get from one island to the other, so it's not exactly far. But we had gone up for the weekend. It was, yes, we were there to take pictures, but we were also there to have fun. And that's a really important part of photography, especially in the beginning. If you're not super motivated on your own or you don't have that clear vision of what you want, having a photography buddy is super helpful, just having someone to go and shoot with, because you might not be up for it, but they are, so they'll convince you to go. I just think it's much more productive when you've got especially in the beginning, when you've got a friend to shoot with. And we were there for the night because the plan was to try and shoot the Milky Way or Star Trails. I can't remember specifically that because we had gone up for several times for the weekend. But yeah, there is downtime to kill during the day when the light is harsh. But we had planned to shoot different things. And being small, you can actually cover multiple locations in one night. So if you're just shooting what I call a starscape, which isn't specifically the Milky Way or a star trail, where you just want a shot of a particular alignment of the stars, like, I don't know, or some major or some minor and a particular formation in the landscape, you can get that shot within, you know, if you know what you're doing, hike to the spot, 10, 15 minutes, shoot your foreground, shoot your sky frame, and you can move on to another location if you've planned it well enough.
Yeah, that's true. Like, if you know the area particularly well, it might not even take a long time to actually set up a composition.
Exactly. Yeah, that's why you scout during the day. You know what it looks like using apps to see, you know, where the stars are going to be, where the Milky Way is going to be, where the moon might be, depending on what you're shooting, obviously, where the sun's rising. But yeah, if you plan well, you can have a very productive couple of hours where you get several different shots from different locations when they're close together, obviously.
But I want to go back to actually the camping aspect of this and shooting with friends, because I think that we're kind of kindred spirits in this regard, because when I started out actually shooting more seriously, like in 2010, 11, 12, most of the trips that I did were with friends and like photography friends. And even now today, most of the travel I do that is not workshops or like any sort of photo tour commercially is always with a friend. Usually it's my friend Philip Lutz, and back in the day it was my friend Sven Müller. And exactly what you just described is 100% still the case. Like, if I'm not motivated enough to get up for sunrise, because probably it might not be that good, chances are that my friend might be getting me just a kick in the butt to actually get up, and vice versa. Sometimes when they don't feel motivated, I might be the one that kicks them butt and like, hey, let's just go up the mountain for sunrise, or let's just go and see what happens. And like, these things are very important. So I wouldn't want to take anything away from actually having a friend with you for these shooting experiences. And also, when I think back in the US, for example, when we did a couple of weeks of car camping in the Southwest, like, these experiences that you have alongside photography are very important. Like, doing, for example, just building a fire somewhere next to the road in the middle of nowhere, and actually enjoying the night after you've already have your shots in the bag, and all these experiences kind of factor into landscape photography and make it the best thing you can ever do, probably, because they essentially bring you into these situations that you otherwise wouldn't be in, with people that you otherwise might not have teamed up with, because I'm not quite sure, but this is also a nice origin story, maybe, is like how you got to know actually the friends that you went out shooting with, because I think you might have bonded over landscape photography to begin with.
Well, it wasn't through landscape photography, it was through what we call it, storm chasing. Whenever there are thunders, being in the Mediterranean, it's quite warm, we do get thunderstorms around the end of summer, September, October, November, kind of. So actually we met through photographing thunderstorms. And then you get to chatting with the person. They like landscapes too. You know, and you just start to make plans and meet that person. But 100%, I agree with what you've said, that having that person there to give you the kick in the butt, if you didn't feel like getting out of the tent in the morning, you know, you're more likely to make that effort because you don't want to let the other person down either. So having that buddy is extremely important. Camping as well. And like you said, I think that some of the memories that remain are in the pictures that you captured. Like, you know, if you've been on so many camping trips, you don't necessarily remember the specific picture you captured, but you do remember some part of the night where something funny happened, or you had a really good conversation, or, you know, it's just great memories. And it's time spent outside, right? I think that is the most important thing. The thing that in general people need more of is spending time outdoors, fresh air, away from screens, away from the stress of everyday life. I wish I could do more of it, to be honest, and that's what I hope to do in future. But yeah, like I said, starting off the business and focusing on that right now, it's something that I want to do more of in the future, just spending the night outside, even if you don't get a picture. And in the beginning, it was always about the photo. And I think now when I reflect, it's more about the experience. You know, you might not get a great picture, but you've had fun, you've enjoyed spending the night. like I said, out in nature with a friend. And there's always stories that, you know, things that happen and stories that you remember from the back of that.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. Usually it's the case of how much you actually have photographed already. Like if you have a standing portfolio like you do, the pressure to actually get a picture kind of diminishes over time. For example, like I've been recently to Scotland. Sadly, we didn't get to meet there again, but I only got like probably 6 images in 14 days with an investment of around 1,600 euros, which is a pretty bad return on investment. But at least I was out. At least I did something. And back in the day, that would have been horrific from a like commercial standpoint. But now I'm more like, I already have a couple of pictures from Scotland and I didn't get to take the pictures I need to actually do a write-up for a magazine, which was the initial plan of actually going there to camp. And you already know that, but the listeners might not, is that it actually fell through because of the high winds that we had. So there was no reason to actually go onto the mountaintops and camp because the tent was just been blown away by gale force winds, and that stayed for the whole duration of the 2 weeks essentially. So there was no real purpose of actually hiking up. But like now, 6 days in 6 images in 14 days is way better. So I guess what you also said is like nowadays the experience is more important, and I want to probably motivate all the listeners, like that's just something that happens over time. If you take pictures at a certain point in time, the picture doesn't really incentivize more travel, but like the travel itself, the experiences and the photography just gets to become a vehicle to motivate you to actually seek these sort of experiences, I guess. Yeah,
for sure.
And one more thing though about the Malta experiences, we're gonna talk about something else though in a minute, but I was wondering, like for me, I just looked into Malta, saw all your images and stuff, and I was actually quite surprised that you do not offer any workshops in Malta, because I figured like doing a week on Malta for like seascapes and stuff would be something that people would be very much interested in, because you have more or less a good weather guarantee in the Mediterranean areas, and if you even get storms occasionally, that would be something that people might be interested in. So how come that you do workshops in like Tenerife and Iceland and Lofoten, and these are also nowadays your usual travel destinations, and not so much like offering people Malta workshops?
It's a very interesting question. I mean, it's something that I've considered so many times, and I think maybe it's a misconception from my end that like I just assume that because I don't feel inspired by it, you know, there's no waterfalls, there's no mountains, it's a small island in the Mediterranean, there's very little vegetation, it's very barren, it's very dry. So maybe because that stuff doesn't inspire me, I assume it won't inspire others. So don't get me wrong, I've actually had people ask me like, will you do a workshop in Malta? And I'm always thinking about it, but I've never actually planned one and put pen to paper just yet. It's something I definitely have in the back of my mind. But it's kind of like an internal struggle just to think like, you know, how could, if I had the choice, would I shoot in Malta? Would I shoot in Iceland or Lofoten or the Dolomites, you know, like you mentioned, those places, or Tenerife? I would always choose those places, but maybe it's because my perspective is different because I've spent so much time here. I've grew up here. I've lived here all my life that I take it for granted, I guess, is the word. So yeah, it's food for thought. It's something that's definitely on my mind. But it's a very good question. And, you know, it just makes me think again and again, because I've thought about it so many times. I've just never actually decided to make it happen.
Well, if there is a demand, I guess you one of these days actually going to plan it, right? So if enough people ask, probably because it makes then a lot of commercial sense, you would probably get around to it, right?
Oh yeah, for sure. Definitely.
But I got one more question, which kind of leads up to the next one still, is because I've mentioned these places like Lofoten in Iceland and Tenerife and the Dolomites, which are all major premier sort of locations where people tend to go to workshops and also offer workshops, and a lot of hobbyists just go there by themselves. And I wondered, because I go to the exact same places. I've been going to Tenerife for almost 10 years now.
Wow.
Even longer, I think. And probably to Lofoten since 2016, Iceland 2015. So all these destinations are very fond to me. And they are fun to a lot of people. Like they're fun off these locations for a reason because they're beautiful. But I wondered, and I thought it might be interesting to pick your brain about this, is why do you think that we always gravitate towards the same sort of locations? Let's take, for example, Tenerife or whatever fancies you, I guess. Why do you think that those locations are the locations that people go to and where there's workshops and there's infrastructure? And why is it that people always go to these sort of same locations?
I think there's two main reasons. The first is because they're already popular, you see a lot more content from these places, right? So because so many millions, I guess, of photographers have been to Iceland, to the Dolomites, to Lofoten, and have come back with images and shared them on social media, you're much more likely to see images of those locations than you are of lesser known locations around the world. The second point, I think, is it's also based on just accessibility and ease. You know, there are some absolutely beautiful places in the world, but they're very remote and very hard to get to. So places like, again, Iceland, Lofoten, the Dolomites, they're modern countries. There's infrastructure. It's easy to get around. People feel safe in those places. I think all those have an impact. I mean, this is my assumption, right? I might be completely wrong, but I just think that those are some of the reasons that they remain classics and they remain popular, is that one, people see a lot of work from those places, so they kind of think, "Ooh, that place is a really nice place to visit," but also because they're accessible, they're modern, they're safe, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I guess a lot has to do with the opportunity to actually have logistics in those places, like the road works have to be very good. Like you have to have some sort of hotel where you can actually stay, and all these kind of things factor into that. So there's infrastructure that you can actually use for those types of workshops, I guess, because there's a lot of uncharted territory. Like I'm thinking about lots of opportunities doing probably something in Kazakhstan or some of the developed, not as developed photography locations, but it's always quite hard to actually make it work. And I think there's a lot of people that also, not just us professionals, but maybe also a lot of our listeners who are more in the hobbyist realm of things, that's just kind of hard to actually make the logistics in those places work, which is, however, a benefit for us as professionals to actually look into this and make it work, because there's probably a lot of people that would want to visit these far off places that just don't know how. And if we can, as professionals, supply that sort of logistical trail to actually make these things work, they're more likely to book a workshop. That's just one thing I'm trying to work around right now, and wrap my head around rather right now. I think you might be able to agree with that.
100%. In 2020, I was planning a trip to Kyrgyzstan. Mm-hmm. Because some of the few pictures I've seen, it's like unbelievably beautiful, but it is extremely remote. And there's always that kind of fear of the unknown. And yes, you're going to get a local guide to take you around, because there's absolutely no way you're going to drive to these places on your own. If you ever, you know, broke down, you'd probably starve to death out there. So I was planning that, and I was speaking to local guides and everything, and I had an itinerary and a very vague idea of the places I wanted to visit, because there wasn't much like material out on the internet about these places. And it's still a place I'd love to visit, but it certainly requires a lot more effort than going to somewhere, you know, effectively based in Europe, whether it's Iceland, whether it's the Dolomites, Lofoten, it's Tenerife, same thing, kind of. It's just, those are so much easier. There's so many more people I've shot there. You can find so much information about the locations, when to shoot them, and that sort of stuff. So I think it's a double-edged sword, if you will, that, you know, there are a lot of places unexplored, which is nice, because that's where you really have the opportunity to shoot stuff that's original and that hasn't been almost done to death. But then it's also much harder to get there, probably more expensive, because although the countries in general, if we look towards the east, they tend to be cheaper overall, it's still a big investment to get there in terms of flights, in terms of having a private guy just going to explore. It's not like, you know, anybody could effectively book a flight to Iceland, rent a car, and feel perfectly safe driving along the ring road and shooting. But you need help from locals to go to these more remote places. So I think that's one thing that kind of sets them apart.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of untapped potential. I mean, I've been looking at landscape photography for the past 15, 16, 17 years now, and I've always wondered about all the places that I've never been to. So usually like on the network where I work, which is called Focus Naturfotografie, where we team up with a couple of photographers to organize tours, write blogs, and all these good stuff. My profile page essentially asks for my favorite place, and my favorite place is always the one that I haven't been to.
Yeah,
because there's always this idea that the best next shot could be somewhere in a place that I haven't visited. I know that there's a lot of people that prefer to actually go to places that they've been to a couple of times before. And I've been to Iceland like 13 times now. I've been to Lofoten like, I don't know, like 7 times now or 8 times.
Wow.
And I always love to come back to these places because I always think that there's probably one more picture with conditions that I haven't seen yet. And it's always easy to get to these places and shoot something there that you have shot before, just in a different variety. And suddenly you get a better rendition of the same picture. But at the same time, I think like going to places that you haven't been to is something that is more risky from a commercial standpoint. But as a hobbyist, for example, like with people that go onto my tours that have been on Tenerife, for example, already and still go with me because they want to see something else.
Of course, yeah.
And then we end up in some place that they've already been to and they're like, I'm happy. I wanted to shoot this anyway. And I was like, I would, like, if I were a hobbyist, I would always go to places that I haven't been to yet. So there's always this kind of balance between going to places that you have been and places that you haven't been. And I try to maintain that somewhat also with the tours that I do next year to some of the places I haven't myself been to, but essentially having a guide, local guide that knows their way around and probably will get us to the best point at the best time with knowing actually through the communication with me to go where the people actually wanted to get for like sunset and to the best spot at the best time, essentially. But I got one more question, which actually this is the lead up, was I got a question from one of the listeners who wanted to know how you actually look for new locations because, and this is just my assumption, in your portfolio, there's pictures from well-known places like Tenerife or Lofoten, but they're not like the usual angle that you would see. So there's pictures that you have that you wouldn't find in other people's portfolio. So you look for the well-known, but you always also include places that people are not likely to shoot. So how do you scout those locations to actually come up with a new picture in some of the places that are very well-known?
First of all, I think it's really important to have those classic shots. I know there's a lot of people who talk about, you know, oh, it's been shot so many times, you know, it's not worth shooting Kirkjufell in Iceland, for example, because, you know, but first of all, I disagree with that mentality. You know, if you want to have that shot in your portfolio, why not? You know, first of all, there's still definitely the possibility of having something unique at these locations. It's just about looking for the finer details, looking for an interesting foreground, you know, basically just looking down at the ground rather than looking up ahead of where you're going. But in terms of like Lofoten and Iceland, finding these places, when I'm on a scouting trip, and you know, my scouting trips are obviously different to a workshop, so I don't run a workshop in a place unless I've been to that location several times and know the place like the back of my hand. And the reason for that is, you know, people pay a lot of money for a workshop, so they expect that that the guide has that knowledge, knows the place inside out, can make those decisions on the fly to, you know, change plan because the sunset might actually be better from a different location than what we had thought because of the way the clouds are or whatever the weather situation is. So when I'm scouting and there are those, what most people would call really crappy weather days, those are the days where I just drive around slowly looking around. And if I see something that catches my eye, I stop. Because there isn't good light, or because there isn't something happening, or I don't have to be somewhere for sunset, I have no agenda, I'm just driving around. I have all the time in the world to stop, walk around, explore. You know, something caught my eye. And if something catches your eye, I feel it's always important to make the effort to stop, because most of the time, if you don't stop, you will regret it. You always think, oh, I'll come back to this later. And in my experience, I never do. So I try to be more strict with myself. And I've seen something. Okay, find somewhere to park that is not in the middle of the road, please. Find somewhere safe to park. You know, get your, you don't even need to have your camera bag with you. Just take your phone, walk around, take a couple of shots. Because that way, you know, with phones and GPS, you'll know exactly the location where you stop. You don't even need to pin it on a map, and review them later. Review the images you've taken and think, does this work, or could this work with specific conditions? And then always have it in the back of your mind. But that's what I found, that the best way to not waste time when you've got those days where the weather is just dreadful is to use it to scout. And that's what I find effective. Not everyone's going to have the same method, obviously, but I found it very helpful to just take things slow and not be rushed, and just drive around and see, wow, that, you know, that rock looks really interesting from this angle. Let me have a closer look. It might turn out to not be anything special at all, and that's fine, but at least you've checked it out, so you know that you've had a look at it. You didn't just think, oh, I'll come back to this later, and then never came back to it. So and scouting as a landscape photographer, scouting is the most important. Yep. Scouting and planning, I think, is everything. You can't control the weather, but you can give yourself the best chance of getting a good shot by being in the right place at the right time.
Couldn't agree more. Although that has a follow-up question, which is, like, you've just described your process on scouting while you're out in the field. Do you do any preliminary scouting in terms of digital location scouting? Because this is something that I do, like, on a regular basis. Yes. Like, I do that all the time whenever I have free time or I have insomnia and can't sleep. I'm out looking for places on the internet, on satellite maps. Is that something you do as well?
100%. I mean, you know, and that's one thing that people don't realize. Like, for example, for the one specific example, and it's something I've been doing recently, for the highlands of Iceland, right? I don't think it's an exaggeration to say I've probably spent 100 hours scouring Google Maps, just looking for, you know, anything that looks interesting on the satellite image. Is this a crater? Is there a road nearby? Let me go and have a look at this. You know, pinning all these places on the map. And then obviously you have a list of places to go to when you get there. But using the 3D photos, using Google Street as well, where there are Google Street images. But for the Highlands of Iceland, I mean, it's such a vast area. And yes, the popular spots like Land Manalaga and Hveravellir and Kerlingafjord, you know, everyone knows those spots. And yes, you can, again, get your nice classic shot from those locations, but I think there's so much to be explored in the Highlands. I mean, that's one of the locations, that's probably the location that gets me the most excited about the trip is the Highlands, because, I don't know, it's just, it's on another level. The way I describe it to my clients is, you know, who've been to Iceland, like, Iceland is amazing. Well, the Highlands is like the rest of Iceland, but on steroids. It's more crazy. It's more alien. It's more extreme. You know, the colors, the shapes, it's just mind blowing. I get excited just thinking about it.
Yeah, that's true. Like, I've been to the Highlands a couple of times, but never led a workshop there because I always think, like, oh, might be getting stuck in a river. Just if it rains a little bit too much, we're going to get cut off, and all these kind of things factor into actually going to places like Meilifjell, for example, which is like, there's no way to get there without crossing one of the major rivers. As far as I know, even from the, like, if you come in from the Western, from the F206, for example.
Yeah,
and exactly. Those places are quite hard to get. So there's a lot of logistics, but it's absolutely worth it. So if I could probably just go to one place in Iceland, it would always be like Askja and the Herðubreiðlindir. which is one of my absolutely favorite locations. I'm just going to put it out here because I think like from the pictures that I posted, most people might even know that location already, just like the ones that you mentioned, like La Manada Loca. Wow. It gets more and more popular, yeah. Right? And I think...
Well, it's actually scary. Like last summer when I was there, the number of buses, and this is La Manada Loca, right? Mm. So there are day tours into La Manada Loca, but the number of big buses that you see, and you know, just they're not bringing people who are prepared to be in the highlands, people in sandals and flip-flops or tennis shoes, and they're walking across a lava field, you know, I mean, but that's a whole different subject.
Yeah, I mean, we can talk about like people, stuff that people do for hours. But I guess there's a reason why there's going to be probably more infrastructure there soon, even though a lot of the Icelanders apparently try to move against it. Like we actually had a ranger with us one of the days on the workshop earlier this year. And I used the opportunity because we took her essentially into Vík because she needed to get there to a place where her car, which apparently crashed down, had to be repaired. And so we took her on a short ride. Oh, no. And she talked to us about like the state of Iceland. And she was also quite concerned with more and more infrastructure being built in the highlands as well. Like La Manada Loca was supposed to be getting a new major hotel and like regular road access. I'm not quite sure whether or not they actually going to follow through because there's a lot of Icelanders that want to keep the highlands wild. So I'm not quite sure if that ever got off the ground, but there's a lot of concerns about the highlands being turned into what the rest of Iceland currently looks like on the busier days, which is... Yeah, I wouldn't call it a circus, but like as soon as some of the major tour companies go there with their buses, it's not as fun as it used to be like 10, 15 years ago, I guess.
But then the good thing is that the Highlands isn't just La Manada Loca. So
yeah, it's true.
If you are, yes, it's expensive to get around because, I mean, when I do a workshop in the Highlands, it's three people. And that obviously in itself puts up the price because I rent a modified Toyota Land Cruiser, so bigger wheels, snorkel, precisely for the reason you said about the rivers. But obviously, you know, if there is a unprecedented rainfall and the rivers are just uncrossable, I'm not going to take the risk, even though I have a modified vehicle. You know, it is what it is. We can't change nature. It'll just be change plan. But... Yeah, it costs a lot of money. There are very few options for accommodation, and they're all expensive because they're the only option. Renting a modified vehicle costs a lot of money as well. And these are all things that affect the price because people see the price of a Highlands workshop compared to a regular workshop, and it's almost double the price. Well, that's because everything is at least twice as expensive. It's not because the guide is making more money because, in fact, the Highlands are... From the ones I do, I'd say the least profitable by a long way, just because the expenses are so high. And you try to keep a price reasonable. But it is what it is. I mean, you know, for those who have a sense of adventure and want to explore, I would definitely recommend the Highlands of Iceland. I've never been up to the northeast to Askja, like you have. But I do love the area in the southeast, like Mælifell, Vangil as well. Those spots, even just around Langisjur, that's just, you know, if you get nice conditions at Langisjur where you've got all those little puddles and craters and the big long lake, you know, it looks like something from a sci-fi movie from a different planet.
Yeah, which is one of the reasons why people actually shoot so many of the sci-fi movies right around that area. True. If I think about like Oblivion or Star Wars Rogue One, and a lot of these films are actually shot right in there around those areas for a reason. So, but I want to get back to another question, which was also one of the questions that I got from our listeners, which is how much of your shots are actually pre-visualized? Because you said you do a lot of preliminary scouting, you do a lot of digital location scouting. So how much of the picture that you take later on is actually already in your head before you head out?
It's hard to put a number on it, you know. I consider myself a run and gun photographer. So when the light is good, you know, I'm not the type of photographer who will stand in the same spot they found the composition and stand there for 2 hours to wait for the light. No way. If I've got good light, I'm going to try and get 10 shots out of that location. So I'll be running around like a maniac, just, you know, looking for compositions. Obviously, you'd have an idea of what compositions there are already, but so I don't stick to one composition to get the ultimate photo. To me, it's just about being productive and looking around and trying different things. And I know it's not for everyone because some people need to take their time or they enjoy the process of taking their time, that sort of stuff. But I'm very much run and gun and, you know, try and shoot as many different compositions from the same location as possible. In terms of pre-visualizing, I mean, when you see pictures of a location, if it's an iconic location like Kirkjufell in Iceland or Hamnoy in Lofoten, you know, you want to bag that classic shot from the bridge, you know, or you want to get the classic shot of the waterfalls at Kirkjufell. And again, I will get that shot, but, you know, I'd spend 5% of my time getting that shot and the other 95% looking around and trying to find more unique compositions. What I really love about photographing in winter is that forget what you think you know. The foregrounds are always going to be new. They're always going to be unique. I mean, that's what's so amazing about landscape photography. Even though you visit the same location, the foregrounds will be completely different, especially like when I do my winter workshop in Iceland, day one is Kirkjufell, so we go straight up to the Snæfellsnes Peninsula. And I ran two workshops back-to-back this winter. So 10 days apart, the same location, completely different. Different amounts of snow, different amounts of ice. 1 week there was a big freeze before we arrived, and then it started to warm up. So all the frozen layer of ice in that little lagoon in front of Kirkjufell was cracked. So beautiful leading lines, you know, some amazing compositions. And the week after it was frozen and there were bubbles in it. So again, completely different. So that's what I love about winter. You know, in summer, it depends mostly on the sky, as in the foreground doesn't really change unless you get like rare flowers showing up. But in winter, it's always different. And that's what's so interesting, having that different foreground.
So you actually never know what the location looks like prior, because you, as probably most of us landscape photographers, work with ultra wide angle, and then the foreground is a significant part of the image, and you never know what the foreground looks like.
Exactly.
So I guess the
mountain always looks the same.
What do you say?
But the mountain always looks the same. Yeah. If you're shooting at Kirkjufell, but everything else can be different.
So there's a lot of pre-visualization in the sense that you usually look for the right location in the sense that you have your background, but rather have to adapt to whatever the foreground gives you, right?
Exactly. And that's why I said just walking around and looking down, because, you know, sometimes it could be a crack which is 30 or 40 centimeters long. It doesn't, you know, the wide angle exaggerates that and makes it look like this beautiful leading line, but it doesn't have to be something that's in your face. It could be something so small. And that's the one thing I see with my clients on workshops, is people don't pay enough attention to the ground they're walking on and what potential there is. And I think that comes with experience maybe, and knowing that with a wide angle lens, you can use the distortion to your advantage to really exaggerate those features.
I would absolutely wholeheartedly agree to that. It always depends though on like what lens you use, essentially. Like if you use a 14-24, it has a little bit more, even the Z one has a little bit more angular distortion, apparently, because it's 40 millimeters to compare to, for example, I use a 70 millimeter, which doesn't have as much. And it's also always a matter of how close you get to the subject itself. Like if you want to have this sort of ultra hyper realistic or whatever that style currently is called, where you have like perspective distortion and then essentially the foreground isn't exaggerated even further, then like a couple of maybe inches, so centimeters that is, of good crack would give you a suitable foreground if you focus close enough and you actually get close enough to the ground. Like you've got a couple of pictures of exactly that, like one of the pictures where you have Kirkjufell in the frame and then you have like the A shape in the foreground of cracked ice probably on the near shoreline and stuff like that, is usually what you just refer to, because that's one of the images that I would later on then put into the show notes itself to actually illustrate the point. But I want to get to one more point since we're at composition right now as well. So since you said foreground is one of the most interesting elements of the photography in landscape photography, is there anything that you would reckon that people should know about foreground composition as a whole, not so much with a specific subject matter, but something that they could transfer onto like general landscape photography as a whole?
I think composition is very often underestimated. You know, you could have the best sky in the world. You know, the fiery sky, everything's red and beautiful colors. But if you don't have a good composition, in my opinion, it's still going to be an okay photo. It's not going to be a great photo. So I think a great photo has a very strong composition, a composition that has a very clear subject, and that is the most important thing. What is your subject? You know, your subject shouldn't be a 360-degree view. Your subject, there should be one clear subject, and your composition is all about emphasizing that subject. So if it's a leading line, you want it, if it doesn't lead directly to it, at least it leads the eye in the direction of your subject. You know, so talking about those cracks in front of Kirkjufell, for example. I think that's the number one thing is what is the subject of the image, starting from there. And then once you decide what your subject is, you then look for a foreground which makes sense, which brings out that subject, which has either leading lines towards the subject or in some way mirrors the subject. It could be, you know, repetition of shapes. It doesn't always have to be a leading line. If it's the image I'm thinking of, it kind of works both ways. The one that you mentioned, because it's kind of like you've got the cracks, which are a leading line, but the shape of the cracks disappearing into distance also mimic the shape of the mountain, because it's a very symmetrical mountain in the case of Kirkjufell. So it's just these things that you need to take into consideration. And this is why I say look down at your feet, because in my case, most of the time, my tripod is on its lowest setting, and I'm, you know, less than 6 inches. The front of the lens is less than 6 inches from the ground. Don't get me wrong. There are times where I'm shooting at normal eye level or at hip level. But for these sort of images, a lot of the time, the camera is really close to the ground. There are other challenges you need to take into consideration. You might need to focus stack, but it's no longer even a challenge to focus stack, because although I prefer to do it manually, so I'm 100% sure I know I've nailed the focus in each shot, cameras now have an automatic feature for focus stacking. So it's not even difficult for anyone who doesn't understand what's happening manually to do it with an automatic function. And that's just if you want to make sure you've got everything super sharp from front to back. I generally tend to, in those scenarios, focus stack, and I also tend to bracket. And it's more of like an insurance policy for me, knowing that I'm not depending on a single exactly. I've got the data. I've collected that data. Yeah. And that's what people need to understand, that especially with landscape photographer in the field, all you're doing is collecting data. It's not, you know, what the final image is necessarily going to look like. If people look at my images on the back of the camera, if I'm shooting handheld, for example, they're usually really dark. That's because I want a fast enough shutter speed to make sure that I've not got any camera movement. And I know the files on my camera, I know what I can bring out of them. You know, when I say dark, I don't mean pitch black, obviously, but you know, if the camera gave you what it thought is the ideal exposure, it would look very different to what I've actually shot.
Yeah, you usually try to keep to the highlights, right? So you don't get any cut off.
Exactly. Protect the highlights. Yeah. Exactly. Protect the highlights so they're not blown out, because I know I can recover a lot of detail from the shadows, but there's very little detail you can recover from the highlights. You know, if they're slightly blown out, you may have, in my opinion, ruin the shot, because I don't like to have those blown out highlights. But you know, that's down to personal preference then.
I guess most landscape photographers would agree, though. I think the time of the bluish tinted whole sky blown out images is kind of gone. That was like yeah. the prevalent style of a couple of photographers probably like 10 years ago. And I think we've already moved away from that back to more, I guess, balanced style of landscape photography. So I would wholeheartedly agree with what you've just said. I usually do the same, although I rarely experience suppose, just for the highlights, but I just do bracketing all the time, which is actually one of the reasons why I actually bought the Z8, even though I had the R5, just because it has a particular button that's just for bracketing.
Exactly.
This might sound a little bit weird, but that bracketing button, which was already on the D850, was so important to me that I switched camera brands again. Because my original idea was to switch to Canon, because the Z7 and Z6 weren't up to my task. I just missed a lot of buttons and wasn't quite happy. So I went with the Canon R5. And as soon as the Z8 came out, I was like, I'm going to switch back again.
Yeah. So I had the Z7 II as my main camera for probably about almost 3 years, right? And the Z7 II, you know, when the Z7 II was announced, we were hoping it would address some of the shortcomings of the Z7, but it didn't. But when I saw the first time I ever saw the live launch of a camera, which was a Z8, when I saw the functions, and it had everything that I had hoped the Z7 II would have had, like the proper tilty screen, the illuminating buttons for astrophotography, so that you don't need to put on your head torch whilst other people are shooting.
And you got the red light mode.
Exactly. I know I always make it a point to know my camera inside out, and I always tell my clients, like, it's really important you know your stuff. If we're shooting astro, or we're shooting the Northern Lights, do not just switch on your headlamp so that you can check, you know, what setting the dial is on. Because you're going to mess everybody else's shot up, and it's not fair. So the fact that they're including illuminating lights is great for those people who don't know the buttons inside out. It's always a plus to have. And that sensor shield is just like the best thing ever. I've had it for 10 months and I haven't even cleaned the sensor once. Usually I have to clean my sensor after every trip because it just there'll be dust spots everywhere. So so I jumped onto that Z8.
That was one of the things that I really liked about the R5 as well. But actually, I just wanted to make a short statement about the Z8, not so much talk about like the technical aspect of things, because that's something what we on this podcast usually don't do as much, which leads me to one more question, which is more of a personal question. But I thought, because we got through most of the listener questions already, maybe I'll just ask one more thing out of personal interest, which is, and this has a sort of like a short lead up. I listened to one of my favorite podcasts, which is F-Stop Collaborate and Listen with Matt Payne, which you're probably familiar with. And he recently interviewed Art Wolf, probably like a couple of weeks back. And I listened to the interview just before I wrote the script for this one. Essentially, Art Wolf put out a new book. And the idea was to show people that not all things are negative right now. So he said, like, okay, well, whales, for example, there has been a resurgence of the population of whales. So we have more whales of specific species than we have like in the 1950s. And so things are not always getting worse and worse, which is the news cycle these days, right? Everything is going to get worse. Like China is going to take over and some people are not fond of that. Like Trump might be the next president again. And all these kind of things are happening that are out of our control. That are going to get worse, apparently. People are losing their hope for the future, so to say. And so he wanted to essentially do something against that. And I was interested in actually, because I asked myself introspectively, like, isn't that exactly what most of us landscape photographers are doing? Because we share the beauty of the world with other people, try to inspire them to actually go to these places, have beautiful experiences, something to actually look forward to. Like maybe the next photo workshop that you're on is going to be awesome. You're going to meet new people and you're going to shoot landscapes and everything's going to be fine for a couple of days that you're actually out there in the landscape. And I try to have some sort of idealistic idea about this. And I wanted to ask if you would agree with the fact that we as landscape photographers may also have like a positive effect on people sharing our work in social media and maybe actually making the life of other people better by sharing our work, inspiring them to seek out the same sort of experiences.
I absolutely agree. I mean, 100%. And like I said, the first thing I said was people need to spend more time in nature. So I'm not discouraging. I actually encourage it. I mean, to me, one of the most surreal, I wouldn't say life-changing, but one of the most beautiful experiences of my life was the first time I visited an ice cave in Iceland, right? And when I have a workshop and we go to an ice cave, seeing people's reactions, and obviously, you know, the guide tells you, for example, you know, oh, there's this rock here. what do you think the significance of it is? And everyone will just kind of guess. And then the guide says, this is where the glacier was last year. And it's, you know, 20 meters, it's retreated 20 meters. That is eye-opening. So I think people need that kind of experience to see it for themselves, to maybe then make those different choices in life. Because, you know, like we said, people aren't always going to be motivated. Convenience is usually the priority over motivation, you know? It's easier to not carry a reusable bottle with you and just buy one when you're out than it is to have to stay carrying it around with you. You know, that's what their argument would be. But I think people need to see the impact firsthand to encourage them to make a change.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. Although the CO2 footprint, to be honest, to actually fly to Iceland to see that is also part of the problem. That's why offsetting the carbon is very important in that term. So you can actually at least, I mean, there's always a little bit of greenwashing involved with the carbon offset. I'm not the one to talk about this, but there's a lot of like greenwashing going on.
I know, yeah.
So that's not always the dependable source of information regarding what is actually going to be happening with the money that you spend extra on a flight just to offset your carbon, which is one of the things that I wanted to investigate actually further, whether or not it's actually worth doing that or not, because otherwise the money might be better off with some NGO that is actually doing that instead of like giving it to... Yeah. A flight company that might otherwise do projects that have no footing in reality, so to say.
You hope that they have the ethics to actually go ahead and do it. But like you're saying, there's no guarantee that they do. And this is why, like I said, I also donate some money to NGOs, specifically ones that I know locally. I know they plant trees, but also stuff like Leave No Trace. That's a big global one. And it's not all about CO2 emissions. It's just about protecting nature and not leaving stuff behind. You know, if you take something out and I'm sure you're 100% on board with Leave No Trace, especially since you love camping and spending time in the mountains, you know, if you could carry it out with you into the mountains, you can take it back. You know, if you took your food with you, it was heavier on the way out of the mountain, it's going to be much lighter on the way in. It's an empty paper. It's an empty packet.
Which is one of the things that I never can actually have my head around. Like if you go to places like in Scotland this month, there's places where you think that there's like only a few, maybe a handful of people that actually visit these places. And then suddenly you find cigarettes on the ground. You're like, how does somebody who actually put in the effort to get to this place have so little respect for the place in question? Obviously, it's a given that you always take everything with you. And there's no excuse for this. Absolutely zero excuse. Other than, I don't know, like a fox ate your leg or something, which I wouldn't want to be happening to anyone, and it's also a very unrealistic scenario for the sake of it. But still, like, I couldn't have my head around, like, even this minimalistic thing that you can do, just take your stuff with you.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling, isn't it?
Absolutely. Like, even in Iceland, like, there's people that just come there and eat a snack or something and just throw the paper away, like, who's going to pick it up?
Exactly. Or it's just going to get blown into a river or into a stream or into the ocean. And then obviously there's the impact on, you know, you've taken something. It might be to you or to these people, they might think it's inconsequential. But if that plastic wrapper ends up in the ocean, then, you know, it's a problem for the fish. And, you know, well, I think we're probably going a bit off topic from landscape photography. It's just that it's a subject which is kind of close to my heart. And, you know, I think if everyone, you don't need to change the world, you need to change your life. But if everyone made small changes, I think it'll make a huge difference.
That's true. Probably maybe if we talk about it often enough on podcasts or somewhere, maybe it's just even the water bottle example that you brought. If you hear that often enough, maybe you incorporate it into your own life. And so that's a positive change we might have made there with one or two people here. So that's one or two people at a time. Anyway, though, as you said, we digressed a little bit and I want to end the podcast on a more positive note, to be honest. And the last question I always ask my guests is who is actually inspiring them with their work? So if I was to get another international guest here on the podcast, could be from anywhere around the world, hopefully English speaking though, which photographer would you want me to invite here?
A very nice photographer I met last year when running a workshop in Tuscany was Frank Otto Pedersen. I'm not sure if you know the guy, but he's Norwegian, and he's got a very interesting take on landscape photography. So a very different style to what I shoot, kind of. He does some work in black and white. I'd assume he does very minimal processing as well, because the images look, I'd say, more realistic than mine. I like to have that kind of almost fantasy feel to my images sometimes. It depends on the image, of course, and the mood. But I'm a big Lord of the Rings fan, Tolkien fan, so that mystical, magical world, when I get like moody, foggy scenes, I just go crazy with them. So I think Frank would be an interesting person to hear more about.
So I'll set him on the list and put the link to his work in the description as well. And last but not least, I would like to thank you on air, of course, for actually putting up with me and us and spending some time with us actually talking about landscape photography and your work in general. That's very much appreciated, and I hope we meet again somewhere down the line.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. And for all the listeners, irrespective of their level of, you know, whether they do it professionally or just for fun, wish them good light and keep the motivation high, because we all know it can be tough when you go out several times on the trot and the light isn't happening or the weather doesn't play ball. But keep in there, keep making the effort to go out and shoot, because you will be rewarded with something special for sure eventually.
Oh, those are great last words. I think we're going to leave it with that. Bye-bye, man.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Great speaking to you.
And of course, I also want to thank all of you guys actually listening to the podcast, which is very much appreciated. I hope you had as much fun listening to the podcast as I had actually recording it, because Sam is just such a nice guy. If you fancy going on any of the tours that I advertise, just check out my homepage, www.nicolasalexanderotto.net, which I think is just in German. But if you want to go to one of the sections that's called workshops, and then you find Fotoreisen, there you at least can see what our offerings are, which are places like Kenya, for example, Lofoten, and a lot of other places currently, like also in Germany. If you wanted to go to the Saxony, Switzerland, for example, and you don't find any other international tours, just get in contact with me and I'll make that happen no matter what. And I guess with that, I wish all of you guys and gals good luck, good light, enjoy your photography, and listen to you next time. Bye-bye.